sometimes the wisdom and awareness become interested in not so much the specifics of what are happening, but more the nature of what is happening. The Buddha spoke about three natures, three aspects of experience that are general to all experience. The impermanent nature of experience, the unreliable nature of experience, because all experience is impermanent, there is nothing in experience that is reliable as a place to land, as a place to say, this is where I can be and stay happy. Experience itself is not reliable. This is the dukkha nature of experience, or suffering nature of experience. Not that experience itself is painful, but that it is inherently not a place, a reliable place to land. There is actually nothing in our experience that we can cling to. Because everything in experience will arise and pass away. And the third nature is the not-self nature of experience. Again, connected in a way to the impermanent nature of experience. There is no entity within our flow of experience that is what we think of as I or me or mine. What is happening is a tumbling on of processes. Nothing solid or stable in that flow that is me. And yet it feels like there is. Feels like there's something there. And so we can, in exploring experience, opening to the impermanent nature of experience is kind of a way to begin to understand how our minds get messed up, get caught in suffering, struggle. Because we watch the habits and patterns of greed and aversion, the confusion embedded in greed and aversion that thinks there is something that's stable. Greed thinking there's something that will be reliable. Aversion thinking that it will be reliable to get rid of this unpleasant experience, then I'll be happy. And yet just the tumbling on, more pleasant, more unpleasant, coming, going. And so as we more deeply connect to the flow of experience and see that that is nature, that is nature, that's what's happening. We begin to understand that the delusion embedded in greed and aversion, it's just so confused. Confused to think that there would be something to hold on to. Confused to think that it would be reliable to get rid of something unpleasant, that it would be a place then to land. If I get rid of these unpleasant things, then I can land and be happy. And the other part of the equation is sometimes the belief in I need to land somewhere to be happy. That is exposed as simply not possible. And this can create some distress in the mind. It can create some discomfort, feeling of vulnerability. How do I live if there's nowhere to land? Greed and aversion and delusion, not having a clue what that means. And yet, as greed, aversion, and delusion fall away, we see that the processes of life continue. The processes of life don't actually need anywhere to land. They simply continue. They flow on. Decisions get made. Life unfolds. And aligning with this truth, we could say, aligning with the truth that there isn't anywhere to land, that that experience is impermanent, unreliable, ultimately uncontrollable. As the mind aligns with that, there is a letting go. That comes from wisdom, and that experience, or the letting go, is a kind of peace, of ease, of okay, sweet okayness. And again, the ideas that we have about what that might mean, you know, greed and aversion, think, you know, have the belief or the view that what okayness means is that we won't do anything. We've got the view of okayness or no problem, meaning that we don't take action. But that's not what happens. I've said a number of times this week that when greed, aversion, and confusion fall away, wisdom will make decisions. Compassion will inform our actions. The absence of greed, aversion, and delusion is not nothing. The absence of greed, aversion, and delusion is freedom. And in that freedom, there are beautiful qualities that inform our lives, support choices, skillful action. And so we can sometimes see, witness the impermanent nature of experience. And sometimes in exploring that, opening to that, we might notice that it doesn't feel so much like a flow or like change. It feels like there's something solid or stable. And so like with many kinds of explorations in the practice, we might explore what is it that feels solid, rather than trying to make it be impermanent, trying to make it start to change. What is this experience of solidity? How is this experienced? What's the relationship to this feeling of something solid or stable? Does it feel like, phew, thank goodness I've got somewhere to land for even just a few minutes, a few seconds? Or does it feel like tight, tense, constricted? What is the relationship? And is it actually solid? That's the other thing to check into, to be curious about. How long does it last, that solidness? When we cling, when we try to hold on to something or try to get rid of something, there is an imputation of some kind of solidity without the belief in something to hold on to or something to get rid of. The mind doesn't go there. It doesn't try to cling. It doesn't try to push something away. It understands that there isn't anything to hold on to or to push away. It is just this changing nature of experience. And yet we do have the experience of trying to hold on, of trying to push away. And when that's happening, when there is this holding on or pushing away, it can be useful to be curious about what actually is the mind trying to cling to. When we really start to look at the experience, the nature of wanting, the nature of that mind that tries to hold on to something, we might think that we're trying to hold on to something actual out there in the world, some status that we think is actually a thing, or some object. But when we start to look at what we are actually clinging to, it's an idea. Even when we think we're clinging to an object, this particular glass cup, clinging to it, this is my cup. Even when we're clinging to that, it is the idea of that, not the actual thing, that the mind is clinging to, that the wanting is clinging to. The wanting, because of the kind of the nature of actual experience as being just this flow of changing experience, the mind, when it clings to something, it's clinging to an idea of a thing. It's clinging to an idea of how I want to be. And we can actually start to recognize this when we observe the wanting, what we feel like we're holding on to, what we think of as solid. When something feels solid in our experience, there's some idea that's holding that solidity in place. And so we start to see that when the mind does cling to something, what it's clinging to is something that the mind has made up. It's a concept, an idea. And how stable are concepts and ideas? We can hold on to, we can stabilize concepts in the mind for a period of time. But they're just a fleeting, just something that the mind is constructing. So the exploration of impermanence, both from the side of seeing the changing nature of experience and from the side of noticing where the mind is trying to stop that changing nature, or experiences it as stopped, or this is never going to be any different, it's always going to be like this. When the mind is doing that, notice that. Notice the relationship to that. Sometimes it feels like a relief. Oh, I can rest here. Sometimes it feels like the imputation of permanence is a big place that we suffer, especially around painful experience. When something's happening, how many times how do we think, it's going to be like this forever? It's like this right now. These are the conditions right now. And even within this experience, there is change happening moment after moment. At times when I've been ill, I found that exploring the changing experience in the illness, the different sensations, has helped the mind be more balanced around that difficult experience. Even nausea. Even that experience of nausea, to just notice that it comes, it goes, it's here now, it passes. In illness, even there are sometimes pleasant experiences. When I'm not resisting and not fighting the illness, I've at times found that there's a kind of a deep relaxation of body that can feel very pleasant. And if I'm not fighting the illness and trying to do something counter to that very deep relaxation, there can be a connection in, oh yeah, wow, the body really wants to rest right now. Letting the body rest. So the experience, the actual experience, is one thing. And our idea that this is a problem and that it's going to last forever is another thing. And so this is a place to explore. I think of the whole of the practices is as exploring. We are naturalists exploring our nature, exploring our minds and how they mistake experience as something that it is not. So let's take our 10-minute break. So a question just following out of what I was sharing, reflecting on before the break. Essentially, why would we be inherently set up with the misunderstanding around impermanence? Why would greed, aversion, and delusion be kind of the way that human beings are set up? Why would we be set up to believe in a sense of self, to be ignorant to impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable? Perhaps the question, in one of the questions to me privately, maybe this is not inherent in being human, but cultural. And I would say there's a couple pieces. This points a little bit or kind of touches a little bit on the question of delusion. Why are we deluded in the first place? And so what is delusion? I do give whole talks on delusion. I gave at one point an 8-part series, I think, on delusion. So there's a lot to say about delusion. But I'll just give a little brief overview. I think of delusion as maybe having different levels or layers. The most obvious level of delusion or layer of delusion is just basically disconnection, being checked out, not being present. This spaciness, or, you know, when we're not aware, there's a kind of delusion happening. Disconnected from experience. So that's the kind of the first level. The second level, I think of as very much affected by our own conditioning, either personal conditioning, cultural conditioning, societal conditioning. These are delusions based on views that we don't see as views. So this is a kind of a fundamental way that delusion works. Because we're surrounded by particular ways that people engage with each other, we absorb that as being the way people engage with each other and not just a way people engage with each other. So simple things like about how far you stand from somebody that you've never met before. Do you touch them? Do you shake hands? How long do you hold your hands when you shake hands? Just simple things like that. We absorb these things without being taught them through language. So there are all of these cultural norms that we have, beliefs and views about ourselves and others, the belief of what's normal in a human or in a family, what's not normal. So we have these views and these, we could call them stories or ideas about how people are. And those get absorbed very deeply, often pre-verbally, not so much connected with language. And they are just taken to be true. We don't even know them necessarily as views or beliefs. We just take them to be true. Now, it's not to say that it's a problem to have a particular kind of relationship with how far you stand from somebody that you've never met. There are issues or problems around various cultural views that that create suffering in the world, such as views around race, views around sexual orientation, what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad, who's better, who's worse. We have all of these views and ideas that can be embedded in our cultural upbringing. And these views and beliefs, just simply views and beliefs, can create a lot of suffering in the world, oppression, a sense of privilege, a lack of equity in the world. And so those are based on some cultural kinds of delusion, personal delusions. We also have our own personal kinds of delusions that have been, we have our cultural conditioning that shapes us, but we also have our own personal conditioning that shapes us. How we were in, how we were met in school, how people treated us, whether our brothers or sisters teased us, all kinds of things, you know, that shape us. What are the experiences that shape us? This is a useful question to explore. It is pointing to conditioning, you know, pointing to how are we the way we are. We come in, the way we are now has been shaped by our culture, by our personal unfolding of our lives. It's not a problem that it's been shaped, but the delusion is the The kind of the not seeing of the views, the not seeing of the beliefs that have been shaped, but just taking, like for instance, you know, the for myself, the view that I was a failure. Sometimes a view that I was a failure, sometimes a view that I was a, you know, really good at something. You know, just this kind of these contrasting views and not actually seeing the like the disconnect between these views. So we have our views and we don't see them as views. That's the delusion. Views themselves are natural to help us navigate the world, but it seems as though, and this is a more kind of a deeper level, what we could call a human level of delusion, it seems that we have a proclivity to take particular views to be true and not notice that something in the way our minds work. We tend to not notice views as views, but simply take them to be truth. And at this deeper level of human delusion, we could say it seems pretty much across all cultures that there is a tendency for human beings to take what is impermanent to be permanent, to take what's unreliable to be reliable, and to take what is not self to be self. So this does seem to be deeper than cultural conditioning. These three key characteristics or three pointers to experience that the Buddha highlighted. And he highlighted these three not to point out some, not to necessarily say, this is the nature of the world. I don't think he was so much interested in some kind of objective description of reality, but that when we take something, when we take experience to be permanent, we suffer. When we take experience to be reliable, we suffer. And when we take experience to be self, it creates suffering also. Maybe not immediately. In fact, that creation of a sense of self seems to be a strategy to try to help us avoid suffering. But it's ultimately not successful. It seems to be able to do it in little pockets. You can, that sense of self can somehow create a little pocket of something that feels like, got it, figured it out. And then things change. And it falls apart, and then that sense of self tries to do it again and again and again. As to why we would be set up to have this misunderstanding, why not set up to understand things as a flow of changing experience? Why set up to want to hold on, to want to push away? The Buddha didn't seem to particularly answer that question. He just noticed that we are set up this way, and that when we notice that, there's a shift, there's freedom that happens. Now, there are some more recent, well, actually, there was a few things that the Buddha said. One thing the Buddha said, that seems to kind of encapsulate the kind of mechanism at work in human minds. Whatever one frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. So this does speak to some of that cultural and personal conditioning, that whatever is frequently pondered, whatever is frequently in our field of experience, that becomes the inclination. So this is one mechanism at work in our system. Our minds tend to gravitate towards what it has done before. I think, and some, there's one book that I read several years ago by an evolutionary biologist. The title of the book is Self Comes to Mind by Antonio Damasio. And he describes in it that this sense of self essentially is an evolutionary byproduct based on evolution. And so, you know, we could think of the gravitation towards greed, aversion, and delusion essentially as survival strategies. Our organism was evolved, has evolved to survive and to reproduce, not to necessarily experience freedom. And yet, our organism is also evolved with this capacity to be aware. It's kind of amazing. It's this awareness, the self-reflective awareness that we have as human beings. This is the gift of evolution, and who knows why this happened. And again, perhaps there is a particular survival strategy to have this in our human experience. It doesn't seem to be in all creatures, this capacity to have this self-awareness. But the self-awareness is the kind of the doorway through which we can understand that these strategies create suffering. The swimming upstream that the Buddha talked about, that this practice is swimming upstream against the stream. Not only is it against the stream of culture and everything that we're taught in our culture around having things and having status as being the way to be happy, but it also seems to be somewhat against the stream of our evolutionary conditioning. So it's really subtle and hard to see, but it is available. We do know that we suffer. I mean, this is obvious in many ways. The Buddha pointed to ways that we could understand experience to help us not suffer. That's really the key to his teaching. Look at experience. Notice where you're suffering. Watch, see what's happening. When you're suffering, you'll see the mind is holding on to something, holding on to some idea or concept that is just an idea or concept. You'll see this. When the mind sees this, it begins to let this go. Why this was all put together this way? From the Buddhist perspective, that's not so relevant. That freedom can happen. That the mind can understand the release from that clinging, that craving, and experience freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion. That is possible. So it's a deep question. But the Buddha was just pointing to, seems like we're set up this way, so let's see. That was his question. Is it possible? There seems to be suffering in the world. Is it possible to be free of it? And he found this, in some ways, it's like this little window of, little place of go through this place of being aware of what's happening. And freedom is possible. So, okay, take another couple questions. Oh, before I go on to some of these other questions in the chat, there were a couple of questions around the reflective practice that I've been meaning to get to that I hadn't quite gotten to. One in the basic reflective practice says you might want to repeat the process of reflection 3 or 4 times over several days. And what I did mean there is that using the same question 3 or 4 days in a row, at one point I explored, and again, it could be anything. It could be a theme around a particular scenario in your life, like we did the other day, something that is a struggle in your life, bringing in a situation and looking at, using a quiet mind to explore how to be with some of the experience that arises there, what could be learned from it. It could be a Dharma theme. It can be used in many ways. It's the creativity of this is for you to discover. But it does seem useful to perhaps not just do it once with a particular question or a particular theme or scenario, but to repeat over the course of, well, at one point I did a reflection on ethics, on sila. What is the value of ethics was the question I asked myself. And I did this for, a couple of weeks. And each day I wrote down, I used a little bit of a journal. So after I did the reflection, I wrote down kind of the highlights of what I noticed in that reflection. And then after a couple weeks, each day, I didn't try to like think about what I reflected on so much. Just like, okay, well, here's what came up. The very first day I explored this, when I dropped that question in, what is the value of sila? The experience, the first thing I noticed was loneliness. And that was a little startling. I didn't quite understand what that related to. But I wrote that note down and I, just said the experience was loneliness. And then each day I noticed another piece, another little thing. And I had a set of, 12 or so noticings after a couple of weeks. And I read back through at that point. Then I read back through that list of things that I had noticed using the reflection with those as the kind of source material. So reflecting on the previous 12 days of reflections. And at that point I understood, oh, when I'm not engaged in ethical conduct, it creates a separation between myself and others. It creates a distance. And as I felt that and saw that, it's like, that's loneliness. And I understood something about what I'd experienced that very first day. The value of sila is that it connects us to other people. So that's just an example of why it can be valuable to use that reflective practice multiple days in a row. If you're trying to make a decision between two different alternatives, you could use drop in one scenario for a week, then drop in the other scenario for a week. You just play with it. Sometimes one reflection is plenty. And you get something out of that reflection and then feel like you can move on. So there's really no right way to use it, but just to understand that we can use this quiet mind to understand and to get, it's like kind of like getting other information from our system, other than just our intellect. That there's a lot of resources in our system that can support us. And then another question around the question, the Fraser question that you'd like to reflect on. And I said, choose a phrase or question related to the quality you're working with, which you'd like to reflect on. And then the question is, does this have to be a reflection on wholesome qualities only, or could it also be a reflection on sadness or depression? And it can be anything. It could be, for instance, you know, a question about depression or sadness. It's like, what's the source of this depression or sadness? And just hold that question. See what's there. So yeah, it really can be used in any way. There's not a right way around this, just that you bring some content into the mind and explore how you are with that in the moment, and be curious about that, and notice I wouldn't so much follow the train of thoughts there that come up, but just notice that thoughts do arise. Take note of what thoughts do arise. Let's see. Why don't we open, one more, maybe one more from the chat, and then we'll open to. So a question about what someone is calling grounded and not grounded awareness. The description is, grounded awareness was diffuse, but grounded in awareness of breath and body. Ungrounded was diffuse with awareness of images floating one after another. The latter seemed more dreamy and felt a little like sleep. Is there a preference for a more grounded awareness? The difference between these two could be something of a familiarity with the experience of awareness in the body. That feeling of groundedness comes perhaps with the sense of earth, you know, ground, earth, the earth quality of the body, awareness of that quality. So that could be where that sense of groundedness comes from. The diffuse quality of awareness and yet connected to physical experience. As we start to get aware of and more familiar with mind states, it can feel a little more airy. It can feel a little more floaty. And so that sense of grounded versus ungrounded might feel like it's disconnected somehow. And it can easily float off. It can easily be that place of more or less mindful instead of clearly aware. And yet it is possible to have clarity and I know where clarity means understanding what's here. Doesn't necessarily mean sharp, clear, precise knowing of experience, but aware of this diffuseness in the mind. There are times that in my own practice, this place of the floaty quality or what feels almost like dreamy quality, that actually is a place where when I'm aware of it, it does almost feel like sleep or almost feel like dreaming, but not with images, as the mind gets more kind of able to really be with the mind state itself. There can almost be this dropping and spreading quality that almost does feel like falling asleep, but I'm not falling asleep. I'm not like dropping over. But I feel this a lot, this experience of the mind kind of spreading and very much almost like sleep. And it feels like the mind, it's like the mind is letting go of something. That movement into letting go when we don't know what we're letting go into, it can have a kind of a floaty quality to it. And so I would let yourself explore what you're calling ungrounded awareness. Maybe change the language, because ungrounded sometimes sounds like, you know, I don't know, we can have views about what ungrounded means. But there are different experiences that happen. The experience when the awareness is connected to body experience, the connected to the physicality of the body, that's got one quality. It's one way that awareness feels. So again, there are different ways awareness feels at different times. And yet there can be, in the opening to the diffuse qualities of mind, it does take some learning to have the mind stay there without being complacent or losing, just kind of drifting out. It's an easy place to drift out from. And kind of just go into a kind of a, almost a zzz quality, just a floaty quality that's not really aware, clearly aware. Sometimes I find it useful to use even a little like hint of noting when I'm in that space of mental awareness of mind as opposed to awareness of body, to acknowledge the quality of the mind. Maybe it feels like spacious or tranquil. And in that place, what I found is it's really useful to not do that a lot, but maybe like every, I don't know, 5-10 seconds, just reminding, yep, this is spaciousness. And then let yourself be in the spaciousness, feel the spaciousness. Or this is tranquility, or this is okayness. Let that, it's like the being with that. Now this is maybe feels like a slightly different kind of investigation. It's like the awareness just infusing this diffuse quality, learns something about it, is with it, understands it in a particular way, understands it, but not in the way of seeing like, oh, this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing. There's so many, that experience, and I like the language being with too, as opposed to looking at, in that kind of diffuse experience. Can I be with this experience? What is this experience? Just curiosity about it. Not the mind that's trying to look at it and figure it out, but more learning through the being with. There was another question a few days ago about investigation and the mind. Let's see if I can find the question. Oh, I'm not finding it. But something along the lines of, my mind doesn't naturally investigate, it more kind of just hangs out with experience. And so what I would say is that, you know, so the question kind of like, is this enough? Just hanging out with experience. Sometimes the being with, not where it feels like I'm doing a kind of a looking at, or I'm figuring out, or even that there's a kind of an understanding happening right in the moment of seeing a kind of an unfolding condition experience. So the being with experience is a kind of investigation. When the mindfulness and wisdom are with experience, the wisdom begins to put together the understanding, and it doesn't always happen on our own kind of time frame, and it doesn't always happen in the way that we think of wisdom happening. There have been experiences I've had in seeing something after the fact that something is gone, that it disappeared when I was never, I wasn't even looking at it. Wisdom arose and created the conditions for a whole shift of a pattern. And it happened behind the scenes. I didn't. I only noticed after the fact that that pattern was gone. And so wisdom operates in a lot of different ways. But if we are being with experience, you know, just that being with. Now, it does take that kind of recognition of, is it complacent? Is there complacency? The complacent, like, oh yeah, this is great. You know, that probably is not going to have the wisdom in there. But if it's a, oh, this is what's here. The sense of being with experience, the being with, the wisdom will be doing the work of the investigation. So it takes a kind of a trust. And this, I spoke the other day about kind of looking back over a longer period of time in terms of seeing how wisdom has functioned in our practice. We're seeing that there's more balance of mind, less suffering. Wisdom has been shaping the mind.